Welcome to Luxury Leaders, your favorite podcast for all things hospitality and luxury. Today's guest for episode 3 is Janu Piri. He is the CEO of the Dorchester Collection. Good afternoon, Janu. You're in London, correct?
Yes, hello, and good afternoon to you as well. And hello to all of the listeners.
Janu's been with the Dorchester Collection for 13 years. 13 was actually my soccer jersey number back in the day. And the reason I picked that number was because I wasn't superstitious, but for anyone who was on the other team, they would think I was bad luck for them. So I went with it.
Very clever. Very clever.
Thank you. Speaking of football, soccer, you being in London, is that a big influence in your life?
It's really not, which I know most people here in England think I'm crazy for it, but I grew up in actually Canada, so I'm more of a hockey fan, and I played hockey when I was young, so that's more in my blood than football or soccer. I mean, I do enjoy it, and over here you kind of have no choice to like it in Europe, but it's not my go-to sport, no.
Got it. And you said you played hockey. How old were you when you played hockey? Tell me about that.
Well, my in good old Canadian tradition, you start when you're really young. So I think I was probably around 4 or 5 when I was putting on those skates and getting onto the ice. And I played up until really about the age of 13. So
number 13 again.
There you go. Everything changed, I guess.
Yeah. Awesome. And did you bring any of those experiences from your athletic world into your professional life?
I think there's a natural way to look at the way sports teams are managed and how you inspire people and how you get a winning team put together and how everyone plays their part. I think it naturally becomes part of how you want to lead a team and manage a team. I'm not one to use sport metaphors per se, but definitely in how people have to work together and how you have to overcome challenges that come your way, how you look at competition, definitely it plays an impact on leading for sure.
What about your tenacity as an athlete? Did that flow into your ventures in hospitality?
I mean, certainly I'm competitive. I mean, I've been very lucky in my career. You know, I've everything that I've sort of gone into, I really wanted to always put my full on into it. I always think that if you're going to do something, go for it. If you don't like it, that's fine. You can always change. But you're not for worth of not wanting to try really hard to do it. So I think there is a certain tenacity of that. I think like anyone, there's a competitive spirit, especially when you work in the hospitality industry. We're blessed around the world with so many amazing hotel companies, so many amazing hotels, brands, all of those types of things. So there's always a bit of a competition wanting to be better than the rest. But it's not necessarily what drives me. It's what inspires me.
How did you get into the early starts of your hospitality career?
Yeah, I think I always was one of those people that really liked to work. When I was young, I had the paper route and, you know, all of those types of things. And in Canada, when I was young, in order to work, you had to really be 15 years old, but your parents could sign a paper and you could start when you were 14. So my parents signed the paper and I started working at the local McDonald's. Yeah, I enjoyed that very, very much. It was a great opportunity. You know, when you're working, you're going to high school. It was a great opportunity to earn money. And I just enjoyed the camaraderie of working on a team. And that's sort of probably what sparked my interest in hospitality, I should say. Finished high school, went on to you know, secondary school, let's say, and started just to work in hospitality and tourism and kind of went from there and started at the grassroots. I began as a room cleaner, you know, cleaning the rooms and all of that kind of stuff. Did not particularly enjoy that role. But, you know, what I did enjoy was, again, this team spirit. You had all these people. You had so much work to do in 8 hours. I was the only boy on the team as well, and I was surrounded by these other wonderful room attendants that were more my mother's age, actually. So I sort of became their, you know, de facto son, let's say. So they kind of took care of me, and they would even like cook food for me, and they would help me, and I would help them. And I just thought it was the most amazing thing ever. And it really is what inspired me to stay in hotels. And then, of course, you know, worked in a lot of different areas, food and beverage, engineering, front desk. You name it, I worked in it. Finally went into human resources and then worked my way up. And, here I am today, 35 years later, and now I'm a CEO. So from room attendant to CEO, I'm quite proud of that journey.
Did you take some of that, you said those women kind of treated you like a son. Did you take some of that and to your leadership and reverse that? And
Definitely. I think it's probably why I enjoyed working in the people and culture world for so long. Because this whole idea that you could create something and you could create a team. The wonderful thing about having employees is, you know, it's really twofold. You get to build these long-term relationships with them, you know, because they're there every day. So you have an impact on what they do. And I've always believed HR is not about giving somebody a job. It's about giving them an opportunity to live. As a result of that job, they can pay rent, they can get married, they can have boyfriends and girlfriends, they can go out for dinner. And I think that's such an awesome responsibility to have. And so for me, I treated it like that. I was sort of looked at the higher purpose behind the job versus just, you know, you hire people, you sometimes sadly had to let them go, or you know, did parties or you did compensation surveys. You know, that's not really what it was about for me. It was about that opportunity to create something and create an environment where people feel safe and they feel respected and hopefully that they can grow like I had the opportunity to grow. And I think that's really important. And I think every job needs to be looked at that way.
So you had the power to help people's lives get better.
Yeah. And it's a really beautiful thing when you can do that. And I've had conversations with the team members and employees over the years, and you know, they've said that, you know, because of this job, I was able to sponsor my family from India to come to Canada, or from Mexico to come to the United States, or whatever the case may be. And you feel so special when you hear those words, you know, because of this job, I was able to get a mortgage or buy a home for my family. You know, these are the things that need to motivate leaders and managers nowadays, and always should have. Because it's so much higher than just, you know, we need to serve the coffee and make the beds, which is important. But the reason we're doing that is even greater. And I think that's what's key with leadership.
I'm sure that had to, you know, in moments when things got tough or challenging, thinking back on that and pausing and reflecting on that would help you through the tough times.
You know, I was actually having a conversation earlier today with one of my leaders, and I was saying, you know, sometimes you can do everything right and something can still go wrong, right? But the intention of doing it right, you know, life has usually a better imagination than we do, and we plan and we plan and we plan. But the reality of dealing with the situation at hand, you know, many things can come at you. And, you know, people forget hospitality is a 24/7 business, 365. It never ends. You know, we're busy at Christmas time when most people are at home enjoying time with their families. You know, so we have to look at the world very differently in how we lead, how we motivate different people. And I think this is sort of what you need to take into consideration. And so, as I said, you know, you have to just be ready to adapt and be agile. Because that's what our industry is. And it always has been. But I think people like to put it in sometimes into little boxes and want to go in one direction. But it never happens like that. So think differently right from the start.
And you mentioned different directions. I'm sure you're, you know, you mentioned you started in housekeeping. You know, I know you went into food and beverage. You got to touch a lot of different aspects. How has that influenced your leadership style now as a CEO?
I mean, it's so beneficial. You know, you're faced with various different things, from operational decisions to strategic decisions to leadership decisions to, you know, employee experience, guest experience, all of those types of things, and understanding the part that all of us have to do together in the different teams. You know, we're greater than the sum of our parts. You know, an average hotel has up to 26 different departments in it, you know, and there's random as, you know, yes, there's front office and yes, there's food and beverage, but there's also a floral department, or there's engineering, or there's groundsmen if you have resorts. And, you know, there are all these different departments that have to work simultaneously together in order to achieve that one perfect experience or that elevated experience, or for a guest or also an employee. You know, and how that comes together, and, you know, how the locker rooms are cleaned to the food you serve in your canteens and all of those types of things. So having that knowledge of many of those departments, you know, throughout my career, I've probably worked through 18 different departments. at different times, sometimes short stints, sometimes larger stints. So when you're able to make decisions or think about strategic directions, it's helpful to have had that experience or at least touch that world at one part of the other. You know, when you're making decisions, what's really important to me all the time is that, you know, the legacy of those decisions. It's great to make a decision and we're tasked with that every single day, but you know, what are they going to say about that decision when you're not in the room? What are they going to say about that decision a year from now or 5 years from now? Because how many times do we start jobs and you think, why are they doing it this way? Well, the reality is somewhere along that company's history, somebody made a decision to do that. So, you know, it's really important to take that. So the more knowledge you have, the more experience you have, it really helps you in the move forward, I think.
And to get to where you are as a CEO, how did you move your career along? Did you always want to be CEO? Did it ever even cross your mind until you were given the job?
Truly, it never crossed my mind until about, you know, 2 years ago when my current, you know, the previous CEO said to me, you know, we're thinking about doing this. What do you think? And I remember I was quite taken aback because I never really saw my career going in that way. When I had gone into the various different departments and then I went into human resources or people and culture, as we later called it, I think I thought to myself, I'm actually exactly where I needed to be. I enjoyed what I was doing. I literally woke up every day being happy with the job I had. And not a lot of people can say they wake up being happy with their job, right? And I remember thinking to myself, I am happy, you know, even in, and you know, those happinesses help you go through the ups and downs that every job has, right? And I wanted to continue my career. And I thought I had reached chief people and culture officer, was very, very happy, was doing a fine job, I was doing. And even when I moved into the chief operations role, it was never expected. It was a conversation that, again, somebody above me had and said, you know, we see this potential in you. Why don't you consider it? And I was lucky enough to be able to have these back and forth conversations where I was like, well, I've seen what chief operations people do. I want to do it this way. What do you think? Which is why I was able to have a role that called Chief Operations and Culture, because to me, it's all about the culture and how you operate the hotels, and sort of went from there. And then when this role came up, it just seemed to be logical, I suppose, even though I kind of thought I would stay in my other role for many years as well. So I was very motivated to get to Chief People Officer. I was pleasantly surprised to get to Chief Executive Officer, let's say, but I love the role. I mean, I feel blessed to be able to be in this position.
What's the biggest difference and what's your favorite thing about that difference? Yeah.
You know, it's very interesting. You know, when I took the role, it felt like I was kind of climbing a rock wall, you know, because you didn't know what you didn't know and you were trying to understand how all the pieces come together. I think the biggest thing I enjoy the most is, you know, all of those things you think about your whole career and you think about, you know, the way companies run, now you're in a position to positively affect those changes and it can be quite exciting. But then you quickly realize there was reasons for things that were done a certain way. And it's not just as easy as you deciding in your office that this is the way it's going to be. You know, you have a whole company to change or to take on a journey with you. So that's been really fascinating to see. I think up until this particular role, the art of persuasion and the art of conversation and relationship plays a heavy role in what you do, you know, because you're trying to take people on that journey with you and convince you when you're in these positions. When you're in the CEO role, you realize what you say is sort of like the golden rule for everyone else. So you find yourself being really careful what you say, because it used to be about conversations. And sometimes it's about, well, you know, you're the CEO and you've said this, so obviously this is the direction we need to go in. Whereas sometimes I'm like, no, I'm still in the forming and norming, you know, part of the decision-making process. So, you know, these are things you learn when you're new in a role and people see you differently. You know, you went from having relationships with people to all of a sudden they report to you. So, you know, that's a big change too, but it's been a very welcome journey. Thankfully, I've worked in this company for a long time, so I know the people and you can grow with them and they grow with you because, you know, they look to you for a different type of guidance now.
So from what I understand, from what I hear, it used to be more of a two-way dialogue, and now you're kind of the one in charge of...
No. It's still a two-way dialogue, but how you communicate needs to evolve, I suppose, right? There's always going to be two-way. We're definitely a relationship-based company, and I'm a relationship-based manager, leader. You know, I like to agree on things and things along those lines. But, you know, sometimes when you're in a certain position, there's decisions that just need to be made. And so you make these types of decisions. But you try to keep those far and few between because you want to take people on that journey with you. But sometimes, you know, you have a responsibility to your, you know, even as CEO, you still have a boss on top of you. I have a board and I have owners and all of those types of things. So it's relative, right? But as I said, you know, the ability to make positive changes is really what inspires me.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
And you talked about the culture there. Can you elaborate more about the culture you've created or helped create and sure. Where it's going?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we talk about culture, it's important to understand the way we define culture in our organization. So we define culture as the decisions that people make. So that's what actually creates the culture in the business. So it can be as simple as, you know, a guest comes to you with an issue or a concern or a problem or whatever the case may be. Do you decide to own that? Or do you decide to pass it on to somebody else? Do you decide to take immediate action or do you sit on it? It's the same when two employees are in the back of house and they pass each other. It's a decision on whether you acknowledge a fellow employee, whether you say hello or good morning or smile at them, or you just, you know, cross paths and that's it. You know, one has a positive effect on your culture and one may have a neutral or negative effect on your culture. So this is how we do it. So when we looked at evolving the Dorchester Collection culture, it was really about that idea around our five values: passion, personality, respect, working together, and creativity. And what are the behaviors that need to happen that help bring those values to life? So we spend a lot of time talking about those, a lot of time talking about the behaviors around, you know, what does it mean to be passionate? You know, passion is not about excitable and, you know, it's about wanting to deliver the best you can every single day. So how do you do that through the decisions you make? How do you do that through the training? How do you do that through how you support your fellow colleagues, things along those lines? So this is what we've done. So we tie everything into it, our award system, our performance reviews, our feedback channels, our training, our learning academies, everything is based on decisions around the values that, how does that brought to life? We moved away from things like having, you know, 1,000-point inspections. We don't do Forbes. We don't do LQA. You know, we don't do things like that because we believe we're not trying to be like every other organization and every other company out there. We're trying to be Dorchester Collection. And so as a result, this is the type of hotels we want to run. These are the behaviors we want to see. And we evaluate on based on that. And that's how it helps bring the culture to life.
Speaking of, you want to be Dorchester Collection, how do you go about deciding, you know, how big you become? How many hotels you have?
Yeah, we're very fortunate. You know, we're a privately owned company. You know, we have one management contract. We may have a couple more in the future, but, you know, it's never been about the size issue with us. We've never been trying to be, you know, 30 hotels, 40 hotels, 100 hotels, 600 hotels and more. Some companies are even more than that. We believe in, we're very lucky. We have some legendary hotels, you know, the Beverly Hills Hotel, the Plaza Atenea, the Principe de Savoy, the Dorchester in London. You know, these are iconic, you know, brands unto themselves. And we're very lucky to have, you know, all these 10 hotels under one brand, which is quite remarkable. You know, I think there's other companies that would love to have one of our hotels, let alone, you know, we have multiple iconic properties. And so for us, it's about, you know, only wanting to stay truly five-star luxury, not compromising on that, giving the best possible guest experience, the best possible employee experience, and moving from there. We've talked about some other locations, you know, that would be nice to have. You know, we just opened in Dubai. We're building a hotel in Tokyo, but they're very select. We only want to be in first-tier cities. You know, we want to be in the right location. We turn away probably 90% of the ones that come to us because they just don't fit the brand. So we're very protective over the brand, but we can be because we're a privately owned company. So it's a different way of looking at it than maybe other brands do, where they need bigger returns or they need fees or whatever the case may be. But I can't speak to those other brands. I don't do their development. So all I can speak is to DC. So
it's really about quality over quantity.
Very much, very much. And we spend a lot of time in that. We our smallest hotel, 45 Park Lane, has only 45 rooms, you know, but has 160 employees at it. You know, we really focus on the service, focus on the experience, focus on the quality of the product, the quality of the cleanliness, and definitely elevating the feeling people have when they come into the hotels. We want them to feel like they're somewhere that really is legendary.
What's been the biggest thing that you've changed or implemented that you're proud of as your role as CEO?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a variety of things. You know, when I think back over the 13 years, you know, we've probably implemented, or certainly I've been responsible for implementation at various levels, small and big, probably 40 different initiatives. So it's a wide variety of things and other things you partner with. I don't know if there's one particular thing, because I really believe it's been on a journey. What I'm really most proud of is how people have gone on that and how we've taken them on that and sort of gotten them to understand that we need to look at our guest experience differently, you know, putting the guest at the center. You know, most companies and most hotels put the guest room at the center, you know, where it's about, okay, you know, brand is checking into room 325 and it's all about when does Brandon check into the room? When does Brandon want the room service? But, you know, whereas we're more about, well, what does Brandon actually care about? You know, and the room is part of that experience, but it's about how we do that. So we're quite proud of that. But this was not just me. This was a group effort, you know, with our director of guest experience, our director of, you know, of the front office, our sales, our people and culture people. You know, a lot of people went into that. So yes, you have people that are sort of in charge of ensuring that these initiatives roll out. But it really is about, you know, how it all comes together as a team to make it happen. In people and culture, you know, I'm just proud of the culture we've created. You know, we're very pleased. We have the very, very high employee engagement. We have the highest guest engagement in the industry. You know, these are the things I'm proud of, but that's a series of little things that made that happen.
I assume you have a very low turnover.
We do. We're very lucky. We average about 18% annually, which is quite low. And as you know, in our industry, it can get as high as 35 to 50%. We're a very loyal workforce. You know, we have 35% of our employees have been with us more than 20 years, which is quite remarkable. You know, our youngest employee is 15, our oldest employee is 72, 30% of our workforce is over the age of 50. You know, we're a gender balanced organization. We have LGBT representation at every level of the organization, from C-suite right down, general manager, executive committees. You know, these are the things that we're very proud of, that we've really, you know, over many, many years, really tried to create something that's very unique in the industry, that really does look at us as a whole. You know, when I started, we had only, believe it or not, one manager under the age of 30. You know, now we have probably almost 20% of our managers are under the age of 30. You know, this is something we're quite proud of. We definitely weren't gender balanced. Now we are. You know, those are the things that you feel proud of over the years. But it takes years to do that, not by setting quotas, by just doing the right thing.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, every industry now talks about diversity and inclusion, and, you know, we call it belonging, because that gives you more of a purpose of why you're here. Like I said, we're not a company that likes to set quotas. I think if you set quotas, it actually, it dematerializes and it devalues the idea behind diversity and inclusion, because what you should be doing is doing what's right. You know, it's naturally, if we're looking for a leader and you only give me three white men, then, you know, that's the problem. What you should be doing is giving me, you know, four to six people, three of which are women, three of which are men, you know, also, you know, looking at other cultural differences, all of those types of things, and then make the right decision, you know, as opposed to I can only hire women now, or I can only hire ethnic minorities now. That's not your solution. because what it does too is it doesn't allow the organization to prepare for that sort of stuff. So, you know, you say you want to be gender balanced, but at the end of the day, have you improved your maternity policies, your menopause policies, your, you know, pregnancy policies, your return to work programs, all of those types of things? You have to do a lot to ensure that you can sustain it. Otherwise, you're going to create something that's not sustainable and you'll never get to where you need to go. So, and we do it through something called Educate, Communicate, Celebrate. A lot of people will do think of diversity and think, okay, we need to, it's Pride, let's celebrate, it's Black History Month, let's celebrate. But in actual fact, if you haven't taken the time to educate your workforce on what it means, you know, what the struggles, the reality, what's happening in the world, all of those types of things, and then you don't communicate that through your own workforce. You know, we have 111 nationalities at Dorchester Collection. There's a lot of stories to be told around that. Once you've done that, then celebrate. Celebrate your people, celebrate what they've gone through, celebrate their family histories, celebrate their culture, their history, their gender, their sexual orientation, whatever the case may be. So if you don't do it systematically, you're not really making it part of your culture. And again, you're making it part of your culture by then making the right decisions because you've been educated properly, you've communicated it properly, and then you can make good decisions. So you can see how it all comes full circle, I guess.
Yes, I like your take on that. And
thanks.
It definitely has a different tune when it's you're not meeting quotas, you're doing the right thing. Absolutely. I really like how you said that.
Yeah, it takes longer. I mean, for us, it took 10 years. But, you know, now we have something that's sustainable. And naturally, now we have better recruitment, we have better practices, we have better policies, we have better employee experience, and ultimately that leads to better guest experience. And that's what counts.
Absolutely. Speaking of guest experience, how do you, you know, go about training your team to deliver the best?
Yeah, we're very lucky. When I first started, it was one of the first things I did. I created the Dorchester Collection Academy. So this is now in our 13th year. And I remember when I started it, it was 5 programs. And basically, it was based where you were in the organization. So there was one for like entry level, one for supervisors, you know, managers, executive committee, that type of thing. And we had a program for each and it was good. And some of them had little sub programs. But this became the foundation of sort of how we look at the growth and development of our people. I mean, fast forward to today, it's evolved so much. You know, now we have more than 70 different programs. If you include all the sub programs, well over 100. They're delivered in many different ways, many different languages, many different styles of delivery. And in actual fact, 5 years ago, we took the academy external as well. So because there was such a desire to want to know how we did training, that we decided to launch it externally. So now we have about 30 external clients that we provide training to as well, which was quite nice. We made people in Cartel profitable, which is quite nice to say. So it's really been a big journey, but that's what it's all about. You know, we believe this, you know, people go through a journey and when they start, they have a 6-month program. Where, you know, they come in, they do their induction, they're trained. There's a certain amount of period where then you just have to leave them alone. You give them feedback, but you can't give continuous feedback because they need to naturally then get into the role, get into the hotel, learn about it. Then you go back to them. Then you do additional trainings, you know, all of those types of things. And you have a very structured process. The reality is most companies lose their people within the first year and then the first second year. You know, and so we've proven if you can get them through the first year, they're more likely to stay to the second year. If you get to the second year, they're most likely to stay 5 years, right? So we did all of our programs and all of our feedback and all of our training based on these time periods to get longevity, because that's what every employer wants, because it's obviously more cost effective. And also you want your guests to recognize the employees and you want your employees to recognize returning guests, and that builds loyalty. So it's been a great journey. We have a global head of our academy as well. She does both internal and external. We have wonderful learning development managers across the collection. And we follow a very prescribed formula, but it works very well for us.
Was that your idea to make it external to sell it?
Yes. Yeah, it was something where we were approached, actually funny enough, by the time when it was when the London Olympics were coming to town, and about Dorchester Collection doing some of the training for the volunteers. We did not have the scope or the capacity, but ever since then, it's sort of sparked this thing in my mind, like, oh, wow, somebody wants to use our training. How can we do that? So then I had some studies done and all that kind of stuff. Took a good three years. And then I finally presented it to the board. That took another 2 years to get approval, but then we got approval and the rest is history.
Are so, you yeah. able to divulge who was your first client for that?
It was British Airways.
British Airways.
We actually had signed them before we even started. So, yeah, so we worked with them for the first 2 years. It was great, great partnership. And, you know, ever since then, but it's taken us all over the world. We've done trainings in China and India, all over the United States, all through Europe, the Middle East. We've worked with various royal families as well, training. So it's been really a really interesting journey for us. You know, even during COVID, actually, funny enough, the Academy was probably the most profitable during COVID because we had to close our hotels. So, you know, training is important. And you know, a lot of companies, you know, and I always argue, you know, when times are tough, you should do more training because the customers that you do have, you need to keep.
Right.
Yeah.
So this University of Dorchester that you created, how did you get British Air? Like, how did you go about getting your first client, the British Airways?
I think it's just, I mean, we play a lot on our reputation. We are known for our service levels. So I think that helps. And you literally go out there and, you know, we take a very approach very much about learn a lot about the company. You know, what are their needs? What do we want to do? And then we customize programs for them. So, yes, we have some programs that we've created that we can offer. But I would say 90% of our business is customized. So we look at for exactly what you're looking and then we create programs around that. The wonderful thing about our training as well is that you can do the training, but then we can involve the hotels in it. So let's say we're working with a client and then we'll do the classroom training. We have classrooms here actually in our London offices that we can bring external people in. You know, 8 times out of 10, we go into their work areas. But then what we do is, you know, we talk to them about our service styles or our leadership or all of the things that we do. And then we bring them into our hotel so they can experience it. So, you know, we talk about afternoon tea and then we'll take them for afternoon tea. Or we talk about this is how we lead in this situation and we share with them and we have them spend time with the leaders that are managing that situation. So, you know, it's a little bit of theory and it's a little bit of reality. And I think people like that type of training. But, you know, it's hard to sell training without a doubt, but there's a lot of benefit to it. So
it's a very consultative approach,
not
a one size fits all.
No, very much so. We have different instructors and facilitators and coaches all employed by the Academy as well, but they're employed by the Academy, but they also provide their services to all of our hotels. So it's a win-win for us.
That's awesome. That's a great thing you created.
Thank you.
I bet you're very proud of that.
We are. Yeah. We're a little company, but we're proud of many things.
What's your other crown jewel that you're very proud of?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think it's, you know, I continue to be really proud of our employee and our guest experience. You know, we take a very holistic approach. You know, why would you do something for a guest and not do it for the employee and vice versa? You know, you create these wonderful, magical places for the hotels, for the guests. Your back of house should feel exactly the same. You know, your staff dining room should have an elevated feel to them. Your locker rooms, your employee entrances, you know, all of those types of things. We're very proud of how we look at those experiences. We understand that not everything can be marble like the front of house, but it doesn't mean it can't be beautifully painted and beautifully maintained and beautifully cleaned and all those types of things. I think that's important. I think we're proud of how we treat our employees. You know, we've, you know, when COVID came as an example, you know, we didn't lay off any of our employees. We didn't make anyone redundant. We kept them on full pay. You know, even though our hotels, some of them were closed for almost 2 years, you know, and I think that's important. When we've renovated our hotels, same thing, you know, we've kept people employed and, you know, just to be at home. But, you know, because we understand that when that hotel reopens, they're the soul of the hotel. Everyone can build a beautiful building with beautiful marble and beautiful carpets and beautiful food. But at the end of the day, it's the employees that people want to come back to, that they build relationships with. So I'm proud of that, that we stay really true to our vision and of being, you know, treasured by guests and cherished by our employees. That's our mission statement. And that's our vision statement, excuse me. And I think that's important, you know, and I think it's hard to do that for all companies because, you know, life can throw you some incredible curveballs, you know, like wars and geopolitical situations and all of those types of things. But, you know, how you take care of your people is very, very important to your culture.
I love how you said that they're the soul of your organization.
Absolutely. We're very lucky to have them. You know, it's like everything, you know, we make mistakes like any company. We don't always get it right. But I always say, what was the intention behind the decision you made? What was the feeling? What were you trying to accomplish? And if I feel the intention was right and what they were trying to do was right, aligned to what we're doing, then you can accept the mistake and you look for solutions to improve, be better and things along those lines. But, you know, you just have to want to do the right thing. And that's really what needs to be motivated. That's what you need to be motivated by.
You talk about wanting to do the right thing. I'm sure you had a great mentor in the past who helped instill that in you. Tell me about one of your favorite mentors.
Yeah, I've been blessed throughout my whole career. I will say my previous CEO, who's now the company president, he's been a mentor to me for many, many years, Christopher Cowdery. He's been brilliant simply because he taught me more about, you know, leadership is about listening to people. Leadership is about picking up the telephone and having a conversation. Leadership is about getting on a plane and seeing somebody. Leadership is about doing it through kindness, not through fear, not through intimidation, not through thinking you're better than somebody else. You know, all of those types of things. And I love that. And it really inspired me, you know, the kindest man I know. When I was younger in my career, I had incredible people that, you know, just motivated me to do the right thing. I remember when in People and Culture, my first mentor was Sarah Stanger. She's retired now, you know, from Canada. She used to be a vice president with Mandarin Oriental. And she, you know, just again, those people that help you see things from a different perspective, help you grow your mindset. I like to think that I've always been a reasonable person, but sometimes it does take that mentor to push you in a way that you didn't think you could, or help you see a situation, or more importantly, again, help you ask different questions. And I think, you know, that this is probably what motivates me in wanting our culture to be the decisions that people make, because again, it does become about how you handle situations, how you handle questions, all of those types of things. But at the end of the day, you know, mentors are great and all that kind of stuff, but I feel really blessed to have had the most amazing grandmother and two parents that were amazing, and how they raised me, always let me be who I am, never made me feel bad for it, you know, always supported me. Unfortunately, they're all gone now, but I feel I am the person I am because of them, and I feel really blessed for that. And I think that's probably why I like to have a family feel at work, because I know how important it can be and how beautiful it can be if it's done right.
So I assume your grandmother was a very kind woman.
Very kind, you know, immigrated from Italy. I'm first generation Canadian. My parents immigrated from Italy. And, you know, my grandmother never spoke any English. I spoke Italian with her growing up. My parents both immigrated as well, you know, worked really hard, faced discrimination themselves being immigrants. And it's probably why I'm so connected and so passionate about diversity and inclusion as well. You know, these situations that your family goes through, it's sort of like my educate, communicate. It's great to understand discrimination, but when you hear the personal stories of people that have gone through those struggles, or what it means to the person for the younger generation or the new generation or the older generation, you know, this is really when you can then start to make good decisions and really think about the bigger picture. And that's sort of what's been given to me in my life. And I feel an obligation almost to want to pass that forward.
Did you have siblings?
I do, two older sisters. I'm the young one, two girls and I'm the boy. So of course, being the Italian boy too, I always was the favorite. So I was very lucky.
Right. So those early challenges that your family faced really helped shape who you are today?
You know, it's very interesting, you know, because you hear about immigration still today, but you know, the immigration of that era where they were coming over on boats and literally, you know, had only the money in their pocket and starting new lives, it was such a different way to look at life. You know, I mean, immigration is still a huge, huge, you know, concern even today. But it's very different in the stories that get told today and the stories that were told back then, you know. I mean, my mother was, you know, probably one of the smartest people I knew and hardworking and all that kind of stuff, you know, came to Canada, couldn't get a job to save her life, you know, ended up being a dishwasher for many years. You know, my father worked on the trains and then worked in a pulp mill, you know, but also simultaneously they opened a business on the side, you know, and did very well for themselves. But, you know, it just shows you that, you know, what they had to face in various different ways. And I think today's immigration is very similar, you know, when they come and the roles they can get, the challenges with language, you know, all of those. My parents were very pedantic about, you know, me being educated and, you know, almost not wanting me to have an accent, you know, that type of thing, because they didn't want me to face what they faced. And I think those decisions they make have an effect on you as an adult and the environments you want to create for other people.
So you want to help create a very welcoming space where people feel part of a family almost.
That's what you hope for, I should say. So we shall see.
Got it. Where do you see the company going and the luxury market going in the next 10 years?
Yeah, the company will keep doing what we're doing. We focus on what we need to do. You know, we understand the size of our company. We understand what we want to do. Obviously, we're focusing on building now Dubai. We're looking at our hotel in Tokyo, and that will come in the future. So, you know, this type of thing. We spend a lot of time just really focused on our guests, focused on our employees, and continuing to grow that way. As I said, we're not, you know, we'd like to grow as a company, sure, but we're not motivated by that. That doesn't need to be the deciding factor on how well we do. I think the industry overall, I mean, it's incredible to see how much it's changed and, you know, how many more hotels are opening every year in markets that, and I even wonder how these markets are able to sustain it. It's really quite remarkable. Obviously, things like AI and technology keep playing a factor, but, you know, all of those things are natural progressions that you would expect to see, you know, as things develop, the world develops, technology develops. And as a result, you look at doing things differently. We'll always see it as an enabler. We're definitely never going to want to change our culture where the guests are dealing with technology. No, they need to deal with people. Technology is the enabler to allow. I always say technology is the thing that gives our employees more time to spend with the guest, because the technology is doing it for them. So that gave us an extra 30 seconds for you to just engage and get to know the guest better. And that's really what's going to make the difference in Dorchester Collection. What I think is the biggest thing that we really have no control over, though, is what's happening in the world, you know, with politics, elections, governments changing, wars happening. You know, that's what sort of keeps me up at night, let's say, for lack of a better word, because those are the things that you can do everything right and something can still go wrong. Going back to my earlier statement, because these are things that are just out of your control. You know, nobody thought, you know, what's happening in the Middle East would have happened, and what's happening, you know, even in Eastern Europe and, you know, with the Ukraine and all that kind of stuff, and the effect it's having on our industry, the effect it's having on travel, and we don't know where it's going to end. And I think that's what's a bit frightening for the future.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of things out of your control and things you can't really prepare for. You know, they say prepare for the unexpected, but how do you do that?
Exactly. You try, but the reality is, I mean, you know, we were doing everything right and then COVID came, you know, I mean, and nobody could have thought we'd be, you know, we spend our whole lives opening our hotels with open arms and welcoming people. And then all of a sudden you're at a point where, you know, you had to close your lobby doors. And, you know, I don't know if you noticed, but most hotels don't even have locks on their lobby doors. Right? They're just kind of always open.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're finding, you know, it was such an odd experience to go through. And I think, you know, depending on what happens in the world, it's concerning to think about how we're going to have to deal with it. But we will. You know, the hospitality industry is very resilient. It's got wonderful people in it, and all we can do is control what we can control.
How do you tell your employees, don't worry about that stuff, that's my job?
Honestly, I mean, we do say a little bit of that, but I'm a big believer in being transparent. You know, if American business is down because of what's happening in the world, or European business or Asian business, we say it. You know, this is the reality. But then we say it in the same breath as, however, our focus is going to be on the people that are coming, on maintaining our loyal guests, maintaining on our employee experiences and things along those lines. So we take them on the journey of control what you can control. But we also want to be very transparent about the world we live in, because, you know, if business is down, business is down. And if business is up, business is up. And they're the first to experience it because they're on the front lines anyway. So trying to hide something from them doesn't make any sense to me.
Transparency is definitely always the best policy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So my last question for you is, what advice do you have for upcoming leaders in the luxury market? And any other final comments or thoughts?
Sure. I mean, as far as advice goes, I always usually say the same thing. You know, you have to be agile in today's world, you know, and you have to take risks. You know, I think part of the reason that I was able to move and transfer and grow so much in my career is that, you know, when somebody said, oh, we have an opportunity in housekeeping, I was like, oh, I'll try it. Or we have an opening we're going to do in China. And I was like, oh, I'll go. You know, and you know, you got to be open to that, especially when you're young in your career, to be able to try new experiences and grow your knowledge, grow your flexibility, your abilities, your experiences. You know, this will serve you well long term. And you have to be agile, because, you know, you never know what's going to walk through the lobby door. You never know what's going to happen next, you know, further to my earlier points on what's happening in the world and things along those lines. So, you know, be open to those experiences and be open to that. There'll come a time, understandably, when you'll be at a point in your career where you'll be like, no, I can't move anymore. I have a family. I need to settle. I need to do roots and all that kind of stuff. So while you have that opportunity, I would say take advantage of that, because your employer also needs to understand when you say, I can't move anymore. Right? Because people have to put down roots, and that's fair enough as well. So I think that's the advice I would give, you know, and be open to that understanding. And I think, you know, the last point for me is just, you know, we live in a different world. And I think sometimes we get so caught up in we need to do this and we need to do that. I always use the example of diversity and inclusion. You know, people get there almost confused over, oh, I need to do this and now I need to do that. And sometimes I'm like, take a slow and steady approach, continue to build your diversity efforts. The world will tell you what to do, right? You know, we were doing our diversity efforts nicely in the hotel, and then Me Too happened. So that's when we know we needed to focus on that. And then Black Lives Matter happened, and then we knew we needed to focus on that. But you can't focus at that and put everything else onto the side, right? That's why you need to have a very consistent approach, and there'll be times when you focus on different things. And that goes the same for business. You know, focus on guest experience, focus on guest loyalty, focus on the commercialness of your business, focus on taking care of your employees. Things will happen in the world that you'll have to deal with. But if you have that strong foundation in place, you'll be ready to ride the waves.
Love it.
Thank you.
Janu, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure getting to know you a little bit better.
Thank you.
I wish you much success in the future years to come as CEO.
And, thank you.
Let's stay in touch next time you're in Oklahoma. I'll take you out to lunch.
Well, I've never been there, but I might take you up on that one day. But thank you very much, and thanks to everyone for listening. Cheers.
Thank you. Take care.